I think a lot of people, when they hear ethics, they think it's some kind of like abstract philosophical thing and it's not to worry about in business. But in business language, ethical problems is just the same as a business risk. Absolutely the same thing. So when you surface it to your manager, maybe they don't care to hear about ethical problems. You can talk about business risks, because if you do something that's going to harm your users or harm wider society, then that's going to get you sued as a business risk.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, depending on where you're listening. Welcome back to AI and the Future of Work. Thanks again for making this one of the most downloaded podcasts about the future of work. As always, I'm your host, Dan Turchin, CEO of PeopleRain, the AI platform for IT and HR employee service. I'm also an investor and an advisor to more than 30 AI-first companies and a firm believer in the power of technology to make humans better. We learn from AI thought leaders weekly on this show. And of course, the added bonus, you get one AI fun fact each week. Today's fun fact: AI legends, including Yoshua Bengio and Jeffrey Hinton, published a paper titled Managing AI Risks in an Era of Rapid Progress that is one of the most actionable, rational summaries of the state of AI risks I've seen. And I've seen a lot. In it, they propose, among other things, that owners of frontier models dedicate at least a third of their AI R&D budget to safety. They also propose a global registry to ensure visibility into new and versioned models that could at some point gain superhuman powers. While we hear much saber rattling from politicians and vendors looking to avoid being regulated, we rarely get this kind of insight into the minds of those most responsible for the current AI revolution. It's a short paper. I encourage you to read it end to end. As always, we'll link to the full article in today's show notes. Now shifting to this week's conversation. Today's guest is the co-host of the popular Data Framed podcast, published by the team at DataCamp. Richie Cotton and his co-host Adele have published more than 150 episodes with some amazing guests. I'm a fan of the podcast and have been excited about meeting at least half of the dynamic duo for quite some time. By day, Richie's a data evangelist for DataCamp and a data scientist by training. He helps train DataCamp students and has been an instrumental part of the company's success. DataCamp has trained data teams at more than 2,500 companies, including 80% of the Fortune 100. Richie has degrees in math from the University of Warwick and the University of York. I know from being a fan, he's also witty and never shy with opinions. Let's see where this one goes. Without further ado, Richie, my pleasure to welcome you to the podcast. Let's get started by having you share a bit more about your background and how you got into this space.
Hi, Dan. Thank you for having me on the show. I'm really excited to be here. And that paper you mentioned to sound like that is definitely going to be an interesting read. Yeah, so my background, like you said, I come from a data science background. I started off doing chemical health and safety data science, and then I moved into debt collection data science and then proteomics data science. So I've been around in a few different industries. Each time I was like, oh yeah, this is easy, I know data science, and then I realized, yeah, I have no idea about the domain knowledge here. It's always a tricky transition. And then in 2016 I joined DataCamp. I've been involved in teaching people data science since then. And just in the last year, it's been a fairly small shift from talking about machine learning to talking about AI. It's been a relatively painless jump there.
When I use OpenAI Code Interpreter, I can't help but ask the question, what does the field of data science look like? Let's say we're back here having a version of this conversation in a decade. What's the role of the data scientist then?
Yeah, in a decade, the obvious answer is that the tooling is going to become a lot more powerful, and it's going to make it even more accessible. So it's going to be a wider variety of people doing data science. I think maybe the data analyst role is a bit clearer in terms of what the future is going to be like. Data science is a very broad, sort of fuzzy set of roles. But with data analysis, you have a lot of people who are trying to crunch the numbers on a database. It's a pretty well-defined problem. So they're writing a lot of SQL code at the moment. And because SQL is a fairly simple language and it's been around since the 1970s, and you've got hundreds of millions of people doing this, it turns out that AI is really good at writing SQL code in a lot of cases. So that means things like knowing syntax is not as important as it was. But because AI doesn't always get the right answer. For example, if you've got a very large database with thousands of tables, or you've got thousands of fields within a table, that means that quite often your large language model, whether it's GPT or something else, it can't find the right bit of the database, and it gives you a wrong answer. So you need to be able to read the code. Even if you can't write it yourself, you need to be able to read and understand it in order to make sure you've got the right answer. And also, I think a lot of it's going to be about reviewing code to make sure it's correct, and also turning that sort of little scrappy code that the LLM writes into something that's production ready. Having these more sort of software development skills, that's going to be incredibly important as the future progresses. And beyond that, I think you are always going to have more business context about what you want to achieve than any AI does. So being able to talk to the business side of things as well as the data side of things is going to be an increasingly important skill. I know a lot of companies already have things like analytics translator roles where you're halfway in between the world of data and business, and I think that's going to grow as an occupation.
To that point about speaking to the business, there's this cliche in the world of data science that manipulating the data is going to become a commodity, but knowing the right questions to ask of the data will always require humans. But again, I got to say, based on some of the advances that I'm seeing in natural language processing using LLMs, even that causes me to pause and say, will there ever be a time when AI can help data analysts, data scientists ask the right questions as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even already, if you're solving a common or business problem, then the questions are already out there. So you can just go into ChatGPT or whatever and say, make me a list of 50 questions on this particular topic. And most of them will be not quite what you wanted to ask, or maybe a little bit irrelevant, but hopefully just reading those questions is going to give you enough inspiration in order to be able to ask the question that you really wanted to ask. Of course, there's always peculiarities with any business. If it's something that involves a bit of office politics, so a common example of this is something like marketing attribution. Your user bought something, why did they buy it? What have they clicked on? And normally it's like someone bought DataCamp and they previously listened to the DataFrame podcast. I'm like, yeah, it should be 100% attribution to the media team. No one else agrees. And then you get all these sort of arguments about how should this be calculated. And it's one of those things where there are so many different ways of calculating marketing attribution that you're probably going to end up with several different versions stored away in your database because you want to know how they compare. You want to be able to recreate old analyses. And AI is never going to have as much business context about why you've got seven different versions of this calculation in your database and which one should be used in any given situation. So you're always going to know more about this than the AI does. I don't think that's ever going to completely be replaced.
You're talking to a bunch of aspiring data scientists, whatever that term will mean in the future. And it's a little bit of a nerdy question, but hey, look, you're an expert here, so I got to ask. This ongoing debate about Python versus R versus potentially new alternatives, what do you feel like are the most valuable skills for a data scientist to learn in terms of technical tools?
Sure. Yeah, my background is in the R community. I spent many years writing R code and learned Python more recently. In fact, I learned Python using DataCamp. Yeah, I'm bilingual in that respect. Before that, I'd used MATLAB and I've played around with Julia more recently. I think all these tools are pretty great. They're all good enough for most purposes, unless you've got specific requirements about I need to use this particular packet, this library, or I have performance requirements. All these languages are going to be fine for most day-to-day stuff. You use whatever your colleagues use because it's easier for a company to maintain code that's in a single language rather than multiple languages.
Is the Python community much larger for data science versus R?
Yeah. So at the moment, the Python community is the biggest data science community, and I think R number two, and after that is between MATLAB and SAS. Actually, probably Excel is the biggest data analysis community, at least in the world, but it's a slightly different beast. It's more focused on the business intelligence stuff. But for data science, yeah, Python is the biggest community. In terms of the code, what should you learn? What we've seen on DataCamp is that for our B2C users, so people who are individuals wanting to progress their career, almost everyone chooses either Python or SQL to learn first these days. On the B2B side, it's a much bigger split, so you have a lot more R users, because programming languages have a much longer life cycle in the enterprise than they do for personal projects. So Python's still the biggest, but we have a lot more R users in the enterprise compared to individuals.
I referenced in the fun fact the paper published by Yoshua Bengio, Jeffrey Hinton, with a lot of co-authors as well, or co-signers. And it talks about the important role of AI safety. Now, there was a time not long ago when data scientists were pretty immune to any of the discussion about kind of the, call it the downstream ethical implications of their work. I would argue that's changed, and that data scientists actually do have a responsibility, given the power and the scope of the decisions that the science that they're doing with the data might inflict on humans. I personally, me on a soapbox, believe that it's an important topic for all data scientists, as well as call it data engineers or AI engineers. What's your perspective on the role of safety and ethics in the data scientists that DataCamp is training?
Yeah, that's interesting. So when I first joined DataCamp, this is back in 2016, I was working on the content team, creating courses. And at the time we discussed, do we need a course on data ethics or AI ethics? And back then we're like, a lot of the people who need to know this maybe don't want to take a whole course on it. So what we do is we'd sneak individual exercises on ethics into other courses, so people just get a bite-sized taste for it. But actually, what's happened more recently is people have got interested in the ethics. And so we have created courses on data ethics and on AI ethics, so they're available for anyone to take. And they're pretty popular courses as well. So I think there is an increasing awareness that this is an important part of your skill set as a data professional. And even if you're not a data scientist, everyone uses data, they interact with AI in some capacity. So I think it's important to have at least a basic understanding of what data ethics are and what AI ethics are, even if you don't have data or AI in your job title.
But if I'm taking the side of, let's say, a curmudgeonly data scientist, I might say, look, the data is the data. I get it from some source, and the outcomes are determined by my business requirement. I'm just doing the work that I was told to do. And yes, there may be bias inherent in the data, and there could even be downstream impacts based on the decisions, based on how I've manipulated the data, but I'm an innocent person in the middle. Is that fair for data scientists to plead ignorance?
If the data scientist spots an ethical problem, then they should surface it to either the project manager or whoever's in charge. Because I think a lot of people, when they hear ethics, they think it's some kind of like abstract philosophical thing and it's not to worry about in business. But in business language, ethical problems is just the same as a business risk. Absolutely the same thing. So when you surface it to your manager, maybe they don't care to hear about ethical problems. You can talk about business risks. Because if you do something that's going to harm your users or harm wider society, then that's going to get you sued as a business risk. And so talking about it in that business language, that's a really great way to get those problems noticed.
I think one of the problems is that everybody that touches the data or the outcome can credibly claim that they're not the problem, right? The owner of the data says, hey, it's just the data. We collected it. It's just going to replicate human bias, but we didn't create the bias, right? And the data scientist says, I was just told to manipulate it. And then the owner of the outcome says, hey, the data scientist created this black box magic. And I'm gonna rely on the output based on the requirements I gave the data scientist. Who in that value chain is ultimately accountable for the outcomes?
Sure. So if you talk about who gets sued, usually it's going to be like the company who has created the AI product, and then they're going to try and pass the buck sue whoever else was involved. In terms of who should be accountable, first of all, everyone in the chain should try and make it easy for other people in the chain to do things responsibly or ethically. So for example, if you've collected a data set and you're providing it for other people to use, you should make it clear what a good and bad use case is for this data set. Just an example. So I was recently talking to Joy Buolamwini on the Data Brain podcast, and she's done a lot of research into ethics of computer vision. You're saying a lot of the data sets on use for face detection, they're trained on a very sort of limited subset of global population, which is they tend to skew male, they tend to skew towards white people. And that means that if you're a black woman, then face detection software doesn't work as well. And in this case, if you've collected such a data set, you just need to be clear on what are the different subsets of the population. So when is this going to work? If you're just want to do face detection on white men, then it's fine. If you're trying to make some face detection software for a global population, it's probably not going to work very well at all. So just making it easy for the next person in the chain to understand, is this an appropriate use case or not, is very helpful. And then, of course, if you receive data, you're a data scientist receiving data, you need to check the data set and see is it suitable for your use case.
I know Dr. Joy listens to the podcast. You have an open invitation to join me. I would love to unpack some of these themes. Her work has come up in multiple conversations, and I'm glad you brought that up. So the conversations about the ethics of AI and, to some extent, data science have extended even to include those hyperscalers that host the models that are developed by the vendors that are overseen by the data scientists. Does everybody have some role in accountability? For example, a hyperscaler, Amazon or Azure, do they have some obligation to not publish or host some kind of model that's likely to potentially inflict some harm or create some bias? Ultimately, you know, where does the accountability end?
Sure. I think it does depend a lot on what sort of harm is going to be caused. You do need to think about what are the specific impacts. So if it's like, hey, this is an AI for, I don't know, controlling nuclear power stations, and it's not very accurate, then probably Amazon shouldn't be hosting this sort of thing. If it's something with a slightly more mundane impact, I don't know, something like, you think about like Instagram, like photo filters, the consequences of that being bad or not working, pretty low stakes, and who cares if they're hosting or not. But I guess we're talking about cases where there are sort of serious problems either to users or to wider society. And in this case, yeah, everyone throughout the chain needs to be thinking, if this model goes wrong, there's some kind of downside, then that's a risk to me because I'm probably going to get sued, particularly in the US, which is like fairly litigious. You need to think about what are the consequences.
It's a tricky conversation. In the United States, we have a thing called Section 230, which basically absolves the platform owner of responsibility for any kind of content that's published on their platform. For example, the newspaper press might own the paper mill or the paper, but it doesn't mean that they have to take ownership or be accountable for everything that gets printed on that paper. A town square, or the town crier, what happens to be in the headlines that they shout in the middle of the town square, they're not necessarily responsible for. They're just sharing the headlines. Roll that back all the way to data camp. So you're introducing a lot of new data scientists or aspiring data scientists to this new field. And presumably, you feel like you have some accountability to graduate students to do work that, you know, is done in an ethical, responsible way. You mentioned some of the courses you've introduced. Do you foresee that changing in terms of how more of these themes will be introduced into your curriculum out of a sense of kind of an obligation that you have some responsibility for how your students go on to use the concepts that you teach?
Absolutely. And the way DataCamp works is there are set learning paths you can go through. And if you want to take like one of our sort of predetermined learning paths, then I think a lot of these do include the ethics courses, but you can also take individual courses and it's up to you which ones you take or don't. So we can't force people to take ethics courses, but we do provide them and make them fairly prominent for anyone who's interested. Now, I think one thing that's very important for data scientists to understand is that actually there are a lot of AI ethics frameworks out there which nicely break down what are the issues that you need to think about. And for example, I read one from the AI Ethics Lab. It's like a spin-off from Northeastern University. It's called The Box, and it just lists 20 different attributes for your AI, and the sort of in three broad areas. So there's autonomy, harm versus benefit, and justice. And you just go through going, well, which of these 20 things are applicable to my AI? So it's things like, does it have human oversight as an autonomy thing? Is it transparent? Is it explainable? Is the data privacy, security, how accurate is it? All this sort of stuff. And so just being able to break down what are the aspects of ethics that are applicable to my particular AIs is incredibly important. And yeah, I think I'd love for DataCamp to have more content in this area. It's just a fascinating thing to talk about. So yeah, more courses coming in the future, I think. But for now, yeah, you can learn about it on DataCamp if you want.
So together, between you and Adele and myself, we've published somewhere north of 400 podcasts. We're up around 250, and I know you're up around 150. Congrats, you're an Ironman. You learn a lot over that many episodes. Share with our guests the one, or just the one episode that stood out as being like, wow, I can't believe the guest actually said that.
Okay, I probably need a couple of examples. I should give an example from one of Adele's shows and one from one of my shows. So I know Adele was talking to Matt Siegelman. So he's the chairman at Burning Glass, it's a labor market analytics firm. And so they do a lot of analysis on job adverts and how much people get paid for things. So they've done an analysis of marketing analytics jobs. And Matt had said that all things being equal, if a job description asks for SQL as a skill, then the pay will be 40% higher than not. So just from learning a pretty simple thing, like SQL is not that hard, to learn at all. And from that, you get a 40% pay bump. So that's a skill set that's going to pay off like within the year, easy peasy. So that was pretty impressive. Another one from one of my shows, I interviewed Bob Muglia. So he used to be the CEO of Snowflake. Very funny guy. But we got talking about artificial general intelligence. So the idea of like when AI becomes as smart as a human. And he was predicting that artificial general intelligence will arrive in the 2030s. I'm like, that's pretty soon. Yeah, I was glad I was not taking a sip of coffee then. I think I would have spat it out. That was a pretty crazy prediction.
What's the one thing that they don't teach you in, quote, podcast host school? That, look, everyone's either a podcast host or an aspiring podcast host. So what's your takeaway that may be less obvious to those who are uninitiated?
All right. Okay. So the one thing I was told when I started doing DataBrain was you need to master the segue. So it's fair enough just asking one question at a time and the guest gives an answer and you're like, okay. And then you ask the next question. But what you really want is to have it flow nicely from one to the next. So my tip for the segue, basically, if the guest says something interesting, you repeat it back to them in your own words. If the guest starts rambling, as I've probably been doing today, then just try and summarize it into something short and coherent so the audience actually understands what's going on and they don't switch off.
When you think about the amazing run that you've had at DataCamp, and when you think about potentially the next 7 years, you've been there about seven. What do you want to accomplish at DataCamp? What do you feel like is your legacy when it comes to the good work that you're doing?
Oh, man. The thing I love about DataCamp is that I get to teach just vast amounts of people. So I've done some like in-person teaching before, and it's fine. You teach like 20, maybe 30 people at a time, go to a conference, there's like 100, 200 people in the room. And then DataCamp, I think my courses have been taken by, I think it's nearly 500,000 people at this point, and that's just crazy. And then with the podcast, it's like there's more than 10,000 people listening to every episode, and it's just brilliant. So I just love the fact that I'm getting to teach lots of people data science. We've already taught 10 million or so people some kind of data science. There's about 8 billion people left. I want to get through as many of those people as possible before I retire.
That's brilliant. That's an amazing legacy, and sounds like you got a lot of work ahead of you, but that's
great. Yeah. Too many people needing to know things. Yeah.
Well, Richie, we're about out of time, but you're not getting off the hot seat without answering one last question for me. So think about the world of work that you're graduating these data scientists into. What's one thing that you think might sound like science fiction today, but let's say in a decade for the students graduating from your courses will just be commonplace?
Oh, man, that is a tricky question. So I think probably using mobile phones to work more. Already we do things like emails, communication on phones. data science on the phone has not taken off yet. I think that's going to be a thing in a decade.
Hopefully we'll be back here in a decade having a version of this conversation, and we'll see if you get that one right.
Excellent. Fingers crossed.
Richie, this has been so much fun. I know the time just flew by, but where can the audience learn more about you and the work that you and Adele and the team are doing?
Sure. Yeah, if you want to check out DataFrame, please go to datacamp.com/podcast. If you want to check out the webinars that I run, so we do a lot of presentations, we do a lot of code log webinars as well, datacamp.com/webinars. And yeah, catch me there.
Excellent. And we will link to all that in the show notes. But gosh, that's it for today's episode of AI and the Future of Work. I'm your host, Dan Turchin from PeopleRain. And of course, we're back next week with another fascinating guest.